Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a researcher here from the University of Illinois who has done work on African-American families. Particularly, the thing that we'll be talking about here this morning is African-American fathers who don't live with their children. It is true, I think if you look at probably both the professional kind of literature and popular literature, that absent fathers have gotten a lot of the blame for problems experienced by their children, by African-American children. It is also true that a lot of what we know about these men and these families comes from work that researchers and other people have done talking with the mothers. Not so much with the fathers. And that was a kind of a problem that our guest this morning, Jennifer Hamer, wanted to address in her work because she set out to try and identify a group of fathers, absent fathers, to try to talk about with them about their experiences, particularly how they thought about their children, how they thought about being a father, and what it was that they did, in what ways were they involved with their families. Her work led to a book that was published a number of years ago. The title of her book is What It Means to Be Daddy, Fatherhood for Black Men Living Away from Their Children. It is published by the Columbia University Press and certainly should be available if people would like to take a look at it. Currently, she is associate professor in the African-American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois and was good enough to come and here spend some time with us this morning. Questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people are just brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can call. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
I think that it is true, and you don't have to be a scholar to know this because you see it in popular literature as well, is that that the men that you're talking about here, black men who father children and who don't live with them and the mothers of the kids, get a really bad rap. They are generally considered to be selfish, self-involved, only interested in themselves, and not particularly interested in the welfare of their families or their children. And I think it's also true, at least you point out in the book, that at least in part, what we know about these men does come from talking with the mothers of the kids and with the women generally. And it seemed that you felt that when you got into doing this research that there hadn't been much of an effort put into actually by anyone sitting down and talking with these men and saying to them, well, okay, you tell me, what do you think about being a father? What does that mean? In what ways are you involved with your kids? You know, what it is that you're doing? And I guess in my mind right away that raises the question, why is it that there seemed in the, at least in as far as the research was going, people like you who are, you're a sociologist, there seemed to be a big gap there where no one was, there was a big bunch of individuals here that nobody was talking with, and why that was.
Well, and that's actually why I became interested in the topic. I became interested in the subject as a graduate student at the University of Texas. I was interested in families. And your callers or your audience doesn't know, don't know, but I'm an African-American scholar. So I was raised in an African-American family, an African-American community. But as I was studying the literature on families, what I noted was that there certainly was an absence of a discussion based on the perspectives of African-American fathers. But more to the point, what was there was a distortion, I thought, based on my experiences in an African-American community. In other words, if you were to read the literature, say 10 years ago and even today, one could easily assume that these men are simply absent, nowhere around, and simply do not care for the children that they father. But if you're part of an African-American community, an African-American family, then there's a question that should go off in your head, because you do see fathers involved with their children, whether they live in the homes or not, and you certainly see men involved in families. So that's how I got into this type of work. Now, the question, why did you have that gap in the literature? Well, this is actually a population that's fairly difficult to access for some researchers. At least that's what's argued. I would certainly not argue that. What you have is a population, African-American men, and more specifically, low-income African-American men who tend to live in poor places. And these places aren't places that researchers are often willing to enter. And prior to this type of work, you had work on African-American men, but you also had these images of African-American men as being very aggressive, very violent, and not easy to talk with. And so you have that going on in the academic community. When it comes to doing research, you have this fear of a population. And so you don't find researchers accessing this population, but it's much easier to access African-American women who tend to, low-income African-American women, who tend to be in touch with the welfare system, so you can get them through the welfare system. They tend to have their children, so you can get them through schools and other institutions. So they're a much easier population to access if you're an academic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if the question is too technical, but I guess I am moved to ask about how it is that you have a fairly large sample here, a number of men that you talked to that resulted in this research in this book. How did you go about finding them?
You know, that's always the first question, and I think it's because it's like, well, where did you find them? Where are they? But they're everywhere. You know, oftentimes when we think about poor people and low-income people, we see them, but we don't see them. We walk past them, and they're right in front of us, but we don't notice them because they're not that important to us. And so if you want to find African-American men and African-American fathers, simply think about, well, where might they be? All of them are part of a community and a part of a family, so you'd simply go to where they are. Now, what I did is I always traveled with my interview materials, and I had a very young son at the time, and he would oftentimes be with me. And children are oftentimes conversation starters. So it was very easy to go into communities, playgrounds and such, stores where you might find the population that I was looking for, and simply enter conversations with people. And what was interesting is that this is a population, at least as far from what I could tell, that who were very interested in telling their story. They were very interested in someone listening to them about their fatherhood. So what I would do is one of the first things I tried to do was simply to put out ads, the typical way that researchers might try to find a subject. But that didn't work because, of course, this is a population who doesn't have access to some of the places that I was advertising. So I was a very naive researcher. And then I decided to go through churches and just simply use word of mouth. And that was somewhat productive. But then what I also did in addition to that was simply go to places, as I said, where black men are, to playgrounds, to Walmarts, Kmarts, auto parts stores, where I suspected they would be, more than suspected, I knew that's where they were going to be, and simply had conversations, simply walked up to them, explained who I was, introduced myself, gave them my card, and asked them if they were a father and if they would be interested in participating in this study. And I also told them that I was interested in learning about what it was like to be a black man and a father from their perspective. And instantly, most of them were quite interested and had the time to spend.
Yeah. You said that one of the reasons that you were interested, you got drawn into this work in the first place, was perhaps that you felt that that the images of these men that were there, maybe even in the academic or the professional literature, were inaccurate, to say the least. At least you were saying, based on your experience, you were seeing one thing and what you read in the literature was something else, and that was one of the reasons, maybe the big reason, that you got interested in doing the work in the first place. And also just a moment ago, you talked about the fact that you found that a lot of these men were actually very interested in talking about their experiences, about being a father and what they thought fatherhood was all about. Do they feel that they are a misunderstood and misrepresented group?
Certainly. And I don't think you have to go to black fathers to get the answer to that. Black men generally feel like they're a misunderstood group. But for these black fathers, one of the things that I asked them was to describe themselves. But before I give you their response, let me tell you what the literature says and the popular media, how they interpret black men broadly. As I said earlier, this is a group that tends to be perceived as very aggressive, very violent. If you were to turn on the news, the black men that come across the screen are coming across the screen for violent crime, rape, robbery, burglary, or something of that nature. And this is the image that America, and actually across the globe, that we tend to have of black men broadly, right? When it comes to black fathers, there's another part of that. It's all of that, but in addition, they're perceived as deadbeat, not taking care of their children. How do we explain poor families? How do we explain poor black families? The absence of black fathers tends to be the explanation. So when I ask black men how they describe themselves, the words that they use were first, "I'm a black man," and then they would say, "I'm kind, I'm caring, I'm considerate, I'm loving." All of these things that you never hear in the popular media.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Perhaps I should also introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Jennifer Hamer. She is associate professor in African-American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. And one of her main areas of interest in her scholarly work is the black family. And she has written a book on the subject here that we're talking about. It's titled What It Means to Be Daddy, Fatherhood for Black Men Living Away from Their Children. And it's published by the Columbia University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, someone listening this morning in Indiana on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. It's nice to have somebody talk about this problem. I would, of course, venture, being a white person, that you have the same problem in that group too, fathers who take off from the homes and leave the kids. I don't know what percentages and all that, but I know it seems to be a general problem. I was wanting to ask if there was any influence on this whole subset of in the black culture when the government would not allow a male to live with the single mother or whatever, that you couldn't get any funds at all. Medicaid was striked off, food stamps were striked off. So you since you already had a built-in kind of thing, if a man wanted to be around his kids and couldn't find employment, which was pretty much true at that time, you had to sort of, run in and out and all that sort of thing, which is certainly not a very nice thing to have to build cement relations with children and the mother. And could you talk about the wrong-headedness of some of the health programs, Medicaid, food stamps, whatever, that abrogate this kind of situation altogether? Thanks a lot.
All right.
I'll certainly try my best. I think the caller is absolutely right. We do have to look at state supports or lack of supports when we talk about family and family structure. Certainly, now let me just talk very specifically about this population. The population that I studied were fathers who were never married to the mothers of their children. So the caller is right. When we talk about welfare and welfare policy, it's not a policy that has really been supportive of families that aren't married, and it hasn't been supportive of two-parent families when it comes to providing assistance. So there was a period of time, this is true, when mothers had a very difficult time getting assistance for their children if there were a male in the household. And even today, if we think about the images of family and what we expect of men, they still have a difficult time. So certainly policy hasn't been kind to single parenting families, and it certainly hasn't encouraged men to be a part of those families except to encourage finances or child support. So And I think the caller is right as well when he started off this, and this wasn't his question, but the experiences that these men talk about are certainly shared with other populations, white males who are low income, Latinos who are low income, and et cetera.
Well, that naturally invites, and maybe this is jumping ahead a little bit, but naturally invites you to start thinking about the relative weight of different factors, race being one, but poverty would be the other, and that whether the kinds of family patterns that we're seeing maybe don't have as much to do with being black as it has to do with economic realities that you live with, and that it's really it's about class and it's about economics, as you know, maybe it's also about race, but you can't it's hard to sort of pull those things apart.
I would agree, definitely. It really is a class issue. When you think about class, we find African Americans are one of the groups who are lowest in that economic hierarchy. And so what they experience is a precursor oftentimes for what may be going to happen in the United States when we think about the increasing level of poverty, right? Not just in the United States, but globally. In fact, if you look around the turn of the century and looked at where children were living and what family structures look like, you found that you actually had more white families, white poor ethnic families who were single parenting than African American. So it certainly is a class issue. But in addition to that, I think when we think about policy, the question that I often have to think about is, what's wrong with a single parenting family? And the answer for me is that there's absolutely nothing wrong with a mother wanting to raise a child by herself. The problem is that it's very difficult economically to do so. Right now, there's a push for marriage for low-income families, and I'm not quite sure that that's the answer for these families, because poor people tend to marry poor people, and if we're really interested in improving the quality of life for children, that certainly doesn't work, right? Because poor plus poor still equals poor. We still have children living in poverty. So I think we really do need to think of policies that support families broadly, and understand at the same time that support has to be economic as well as social.
Mm. If you, I'm interested in your experiences having talked with these men about what it is that they think fathers are supposed to be like, and what is a good father. And if you look at more kind of global attitudes, if we just went out there and did a much more sort of random survey of people and we asked them those kind of questions, I say something like, you know, well, what are the qualities of a good father? How does a good father behave? And then you ask the men that you dealt with in putting together this study, and you ask them basically the same sorts of questions. Well, you know, what do you think constitutes being a good father? What do they say, and does the way that they define fatherhood depart any from, I hesitate to use the word the norm, but what is a sort of a more global kind of definition?
Well, let's start by simply talking about what the norm is, what we think the norm is, right? The ideal of fatherhood. And we'll stay focused on Western culture. So in Western society, the ideal father, what fathers are supposed to do as fathers, is the first thing they're supposed to do is to provide a legal endowment to their children, that is, provide them with their surname, that legal connection. Second, and some might argue equally important, is that they should support them economically, provide instrumental support. By that, I mean shelter, food, clothing, those material things that all individuals need to survive. Following that would be protection and simply daily care and what we call formation function, that is, character development, a role model. Now, that's how we tend to think about what fathers are supposed to do. Those are our expectations for fathers broadly. But now, when I talked with these men, what seemed to be going on was that they were sort of turning that ideal on its head. And remember, this is a population that doesn't have access to incomes that enable them to properly support their children. And so for them, what was going on is that they were sort of redefining fatherhood to fit what they could actually do as fathers. And so when I asked them what it was that they expected fathers to do. Certainly, they thought that fathers should provide economic support, but it wasn't at the top of the list. Rather, what was at the top of their list was social and emotional support, those things that they felt they could easily provide. And at the very, very bottom of the list was the economic support and then that legal endowment, that is the provision of the surname.
See, I think that's a very interesting, very really significant point, that the way that they would define fatherhood was not so much, they ended up having to define it, and perhaps not so much the way that they would like to, but that the way that they were constrained to, it was very much a sort of a product of the circumstances in which they found themselves living, and maybe not so much kind of an ideal that they would rather have it one way, but this was simply the way that they could do it.
Certainly. And while this was their ideal, that didn't mean that all of them actually lived up to the ideal that they presented. Mm-hmm. So even among these fathers who had these kinds of expectations, not all of them were providing the quantity or quality of emotional and social support that they felt they should have.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. This is a listener in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm interested in raising the issue of research in ethnography and journalism in relation to the study of blacks, of inner city cultures. And going back to the 1980s, I avidly read the work of people like Nicholas Lemon and Samuel Friedman and Alex Kotlowitz, but I ultimately came to feel that these people were doing their subjects a disservice in the way that they were being portrayed, in the way black culture was being portrayed. And I was just wondering whether you had any views about that and about how that may have affected or influenced your work and your treatment of the notion of the culture of poverty and of quote-unquote welfare dependence, matriarchy, black male pathology, and so forth.
You actually asked quite a bit. I'll try my best, definitely. I think that of the names that you listed, I caught a few of them, and those are journalists. And
yes.
Journalists are journalists. They're very different from research, like a sociologist or an anthropologist. So I don't expect the same things from them that I would, say, a sociologist or an anthropologist who's an ethnographer. I expect a description. Unfortunately, what you often get, though, is some analyzing of the data from individuals who aren't necessarily trained to do so. So it's not that I dismiss the work, but I take it for what it is. I do think that one thing that the journalist's work, especially Kotlowitz, does do is that it does inform. In other words, they provide pictures that most of America wouldn't have of black America, right? And it sort of forces America to think about race in ways that they wouldn't otherwise. Now, you may want to do a follow-up question because I don't remember.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think that what these journalists did was draw somewhat sympathetic pictures of the people that they were researching or that they were talking about, but ultimately they didn't really penetrate basic American myths about the nature of poverty, the relationship between race and poverty, and ultimately it still became a matter of what can these black people do about their culture.
Go ahead.
And I'm wondering whether you think we're getting beyond that now in either journalism or academic research. I don't think we're getting beyond it in journalism, but I'm just wondering whether you think academic research is doing any better at this and is doing any better job of disseminating a less blaming the victim view of black culture.
I would say yes, but it's a tentative yes or a very slow yes. Yeah, I think that researchers are moving forward, but certainly this culture of poverty thesis, that is that the culture of poverty is transferred from one generation to the next, and it's the fault of the poor that they're poor. That's essentially what you're talking about. I think that's still quite dominant in the literature. But there is some move away from that, or some broader explanations, and more complicated explanations, especially when we look at welfare in the state. I think when we had the switch in 1996 from welfare to TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, researchers started to take another look at the role of the state in perpetuating poverty. And certainly my work is a move in that direction, especially my current work, which looks at the city of East St. Louis, and it's titled Abandoned Place and Abandoned People, which really looks at the role of the state in creating an environment where people have very few choices.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Way back at the beginning, I think we talked a little bit about, you talked a little bit about getting, how you got interested in this work because the kinds of things that you were reading about black men, particularly about black fathers, absent fathers, didn't quite square up with the reality of your own experience. And in the sense that there was a lot of talk in the literature about these men simply not being there. It was almost like they were invisible, that they made the children and then they left, and then they never had any contact with the families again. And you're feeling that, in fact, well, that's really not the way it is. As you got the opportunity to meet some more of these men and talk with them, what sort of things did you find about what they were doing with their families and their kids, and how much contact they had with their children, and what sort of involvement they had?
I'd say there was a range. You had men who were completely absent, right? But even these men didn't fit this popular notion of black fathers, right? When we assume that black fathers aren't around, we assume they aren't around because they don't care. These men who were absent still cared about their children, but for various reasons were not able to, or simply did not spend time with them. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we had fathers who saw their children every day, who watched their children when the mothers went to work, who picked up their children from school, who sat and watched television with them, and then took them to ball games. So you really had a range. Now, the question is not how much time did they spend with them, at least that really wasn't the most important question to me, but what did they actually do with the children? And as I said, you do have this range. But part of that depended on their relationship with the mother of their child, right? And then in addition to that, other things that were going on in their life, other relationships they had with other women, other sets of children that they may have which would mean that they had less time to spend with one set of children, and then their work schedules or lack of work schedules and access to transportation. All of these things affected their parenting, what they were able to do as parents.
Mm-hmm. I guess I find myself, again, going back to being interested in how the economic realities work into this, and to what extent that there may indeed be forces that you could fairly argue that were beyond their control, that were getting in the way of them being more involved with or having more contact with their children.
Well, I think if you just simply look at the statistics, you'll find that the majority of men who don't pay child support are earning less than $10,000 a year, right? So economically, and when we think about what fathers are supposed to do, that's one of the things we ask of them and demand of them. That's simply something that most fathers are unable to do, especially if they're not living in the home with their child. That means they're supporting their child, but they're also having to support themselves in some way. So it's very difficult economically to do that. But in addition to that, many of these men worked multiple jobs, right? If you're low income and you're working, you're earning low wages, which means you may take on other types of work, whether it's legal work or illegal work. It's extra time that you have to spend trying to earn money, which means you have less time to spend with your children. So you have that, and you also have transportation. Now, all these things are related to income, because simply the more money that you have, the more access do you have, the more opportunity you have to travel, to provide for your children, etc. But you have men here who, many of whom were doing shift work, who were having to go to work on schedules that didn't allow them to spend time with their children on a regular basis. You have men who lived in one place but had to travel for 2 hours simply to get to a low-wage job, let's say at McDonald's. So all of these things really served as barriers to the type of parents that many of these men wanted to be.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Just as you were talking just now, I was flashing back to the doing low-income tax preparation. There's a program, a statewide program, but there's an office here in Champaign-Urbana. And I, a couple of men that I have done taxes for as part of this, I remember one guy who had something like 14 W-2 forms that I had to enter. The guy was working really, really hard, and he wasn't getting anywhere. And I could see that for him, if he, I don't recall whether he was supporting any children, but that feeds into what you're saying for some people. But what I was had wanted to say before that you said that was that I think we all learn our parenting skills in part from our own parents. And if a parent is absent, particularly a parent of the same sex that we are, we might, and if we don't have other good models for parenting from seeing other parents do it as we grow up, or we don't have help in figuring out alternatives, that it's hard to parent well because we don't know how to do it. It's not something that's innate. It's there are a lot of skills in there, and it's a really, really tough job that we learn about as we go along. And it's true of no matter what your income level is. So I just wanted to add that in. You may have mentioned it, but I didn't happen to catch it as I was working along here while listening to you.
Oh, that's an excellent point, and that was actually something that came up in this study. Fathers, as I said, some fathers were very engaged with their children and others weren't. And there were varying ways in which they became disengaged, right? We often presume that, as I said, when men aren't with their children, it's because they simply just aren't interested. They just have other things to do. But what I found is that for some of these men who were quite interested in parenting at the birth of their child, found themselves becoming disengaged over time. And one of the reasons for that was that they simply were not prepared for parenting, didn't really understand what that meant. And it was the same for the mothers as well, but oftentimes mothers had support. So when a mother had a child, oftentimes she was going home and living with her mother or her sister or her aunt, so she had that type of support and someone who could show her what she was supposed to do. But men, that is the fathers, didn't have that type of support, and oftentimes they were not living with the mother. So they didn't really understand what they were supposed to do as a parent, but at the same time, when they entered the home of the mother of their child, they oftentimes felt like a third wheel or inadequate because this was a household that seemed to run whether they were there or not. So they didn't really know what they were supposed to do as fathers. And so they found themselves disengaging. So I think that's an excellent point. We do learn how to parent, but learning how to parent is an ongoing process, right? We learn as children watching our own parents, but then as adults, we also learn from others.
Yeah, definitely so. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Did you have the opportunity, or did you try to talk much with the men in your study about their relationship with their fathers?
Yes, and actually, for most of these fathers, they would say that they didn't have great relationships with their fathers. For many of these fathers, they did not live in the home with their biological father for all of their childhood. And they, for them, if you ask them, how do you think you're doing as a father compared to your father? Most of them felt that they were better fathers than their own fathers, even when they weren't really engaged in the child's life, right? For them, they felt like their fathers didn't care about them because they weren't around, and didn't seem to be able to put themselves in their father's place.
We're getting into the point where we have maybe about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Jennifer Hamer. She is associate professor in the African American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. She is a sociologist by her training and is interested in the Black family and has authored a book that was published a couple of years ago that's titled What It Means to Be Daddy: Fatherhood for Black Men Living Away from Their Children, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for, I'm sure for sake of balance, you also were interested in to the extent that you could, trying to talk with some of, with the women who were the mothers of the children of which of these guys were the fathers. And what did you find when you talked to them? And particularly, I guess I'm interested in the balancing perceptions of the fatherhood, how these, you know, if you ask these women, how do you think these men are doing as fathers? You ask the men, how do you think you're doing as fathers? Are their perceptions really different? I mean, were there men who said, well, I think I'm doing pretty well, and the women who said, no, he's not doing well? You know, how did their varying views of things square up or not square up?
Well, I would say that, well, certainly there was some disagreement. I don't think we even have to guess. There was definitely disagreement
yeah,
on
I
that.
Respect that.
As I've already said before, and I can talk in a little bit more detail about it, many of these fathers felt like they should be doing more as fathers, definitely, especially in terms of spending time with their children. But let me just go straight to the mothers. Mothers felt that fathers could certainly do more. And these mothers really held the very popular ideal about what fathers should be, what fatherhood should be like. That is, fathers should provide economic support. Fathers should provide social and emotional support. But at the same time, mothers were willing to forego the economic support if fathers would at least provide more social support. That is, simply be there for their children, spend more time with their children. Mothers would have been perfectly satisfied with that. In fact, many mothers didn't want to pursue pursue child support through the courts because they were afraid that it would chase the fathers away. They would rather have the father. They really wanted to make sure that the fathers were engaged at some level in their child's life. And fathers agreed with that. So if a mother were to say, I think that he can spend more time with the child, fathers generally agreed with that. Yes, I think I can spend more time with the child, but I think at the same time that I'm doing pretty good. That would be the response.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello. I tuned in a little bit late, so perhaps you've talked about this already, but I'm under the understanding that the statistics for black families in the early part of the 20th century were quite comparable to those of white families in the sense of, you know, fathers being present and head of their households. And something happened in the middle of that century, the 1950s and 1960s, to change those statistics. And to figure out what happened, would it be, in your opinion, the governmental programs, the Great Society programs, or perhaps the cultural change in the arts and, you know, the general cultural breakdown in society? Have you any opinion on that?
Yeah, I do. And you're right about when we look at the early part of the 20th century, we really don't see any differences. Children are living in two-parent homes for the most part. We do see some changes beginning in the 1950s, 40s, 50s, into the 60s and on and up to the present day. What we have going on, certainly we have policy, right? And that's fairly complicated. But I think one thing that we can really that most people are probably familiar with is that we have a change in the economy that begins in the 1950s, where you have blacks who've moved up from the South into the central cities, right, of the Northeast and then the Midwest, and they come up for jobs. Why do they come up for jobs? Because they can't really find great jobs in the South, and they're also looking for better places to raise their children, access to quality education. So they're moving into the Midwest and into the Northeast and also into the Southwest for these things. But once they arrive, once we see black families and black fathers moving solidly into the working class, we see industries departing from these central cities, right? And when these industries leave, they take the jobs with them. But what do fathers need to sustain a family? Well, they need to have a job. And once these jobs disappear, you also begin to see families beginning to change, right? You see increases in welfare dependency, and you also see high levels of unemployment. Not that you ever had full employment for black men in America, you never have, but there was a period of time with World War II that we begin to see some inroads in that direction. So certainly you have government policy that doesn't support families, doesn't really support poor families. In other words, just because you receive assistance, it doesn't bring you out of poverty. And really our interest is children. We're concerned with fathers, we're concerned with mothers, but we're really only concerned with them because of their children, right? So you still have poor families regardless of government assistance. And definitely the economy it does quite a bit to explain why fathers aren't living in the homes of their children.
Can I add another point?
Sure.
I've seen this also in regard to immigrants from other countries. I just happen to have a lot of exposure here in Chicago to immigrant groups, and I've seen where, you know, people from other countries, will come without their wives or, you know, without their children, and similar to the black experience. And I've also noticed many families broken up in this regard. One will live in another country, one will live here, and end up in divorce or, you know, some type of, family dislocation. So it's similar to the immigrant experience in a sense. Blacks, in a sense, are immigrants from the South in a way when they come to the big cities.
Yeah, but the thing is, when blacks came to the North, many of them brought their families with them or started families once they're here. The question is, what happens to these families once they've arrived, right, in these larger cities? Why aren't they sustained?
I see.
But in addition, let me just add to that, because I think you're making a really good point. What we see going on with black fathers and black families, we can see across racial lines if we look at class, right? Class experience are very similar.
Again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're getting into about our last 5-6 minutes, and I want to encourage people, if there's anybody who is thinking about calling in, being involved in the conversation, do that before we end up out of time. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have talking here about the results of the work that you have done, and I want also to try to connect that to policy. I think we would want to say that it's certainly possible for a single parent family to be successful. However, it's tough. It's tough economically, and it may also be tough because it may be harder to find someone simply to share all the work that needs to get done. And if we decided that maybe it would be a good idea for there to be more families where both parents were living under the same roof, and maybe we'd say that that's not an appropriate goal. But if we said that was something that was important, is there something that we could do in the way of policy that would help? Because clearly what we have done in the past hasn't.
Well, I would never argue that a mother should have to live with the father of her child. I would never argue that. What I would argue is that parents should always have support regardless of the family structure. So certainly if we're going to push for marriage between low-income parents, then we have to accept that they're still going to be poor. So what type of support then do we really need to provide them? And for me, the answer is living wage jobs, living wage employment, guaranteed living wage employment, not just for fathers, but for mothers as well, so that mothers can support their children, whether a marriage or a relationship works out or not. And if we think about why marriages break up, oftentimes marriages break up for financial reasons or arguments and stress over finances. So we certainly wouldn't want to push men and women into marriage that it's doomed to failure for those very reasons. And we certainly wouldn't want to condemn women to relationships that don't work simply because they need economic support. But we are always going to have a high rate of child poverty in the African-American community, white community, Latino community, et cetera, if we don't have guaranteed living wage jobs. People can work minimum wage jobs 40 hours a week and still be poor. That's the situation that we have today.
Let's talk again with another Chicago person. This is line 4 again. Hello.
Hi. I've just found your conversation very interesting because you keep coming back to the cycle of poverty, transportation, and the workforce. And it sounds like the more recent work that you've done in East St. Louis goes again to the problem of transportation to jobs or lack of transportation and the workforce. And I'm sort of hoping that you can come back again and talk about that because that is really almost the central issue now is in our country is going to be labor reform, because that ties into the migration, that ties into our development of our cities, that ties into our even our energy plans. So I would really hope that there would be a possibility that you could come back and talk about that.
Thank you. I, you know, I will say this. I talk about transportation and I talk about jobs. I definitely do it in my newer work. But I'll just talk just about that new work just briefly. When we talk about black men in East St. Louis, for example, who are looking for jobs, certainly they have to leave the city to look for work because this is a city that, that simply has no industry or no large industry. But even when they are accessing transportation and looking for work, they're still not accessing jobs. And that's what's interesting, right, is that you can be looking for jobs and you have to go outside the city to get it. But if you're an African American, you're less likely to get a job even outside of the city. In addition to that, jobs are simply leaving the United States. So we can say, you know, we should have living wage jobs, we should have guaranteed living wage jobs, full and guaranteed full employment. But at this present time, it doesn't look like that's the direction that the U.S. is headed, right? In fact, we have fewer and fewer career jobs available.
I know there's not a lot of time, but that goes back to our issue that you mentioned at the last, the working class or lack of a living wage. What future do we have for any American citizen when we have a group that, because of a lot of problems with our education system, will only ever be able to access minimum wage jobs when minimum wage jobs are not living wage jobs?
Well, now that's the problem of the century, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, certainly we have a growing gap between the wealthy and the poor. We have people who aren't accessing education, who are actually being expelled from the educational system and who are left going into the criminal justice system, right? And so we don't expect that they'll ever really find employment, but they're still going to be fathers.
Well, thank you very much.
Right, thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. We do have 3-4 minutes here left. And we do have another caller here, so we'll get them. Someone calling from the Charleston Mattoon area who's calling on a cell phone, our line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
David, another excellent program. I appreciate it. I am on a cell, and you guys are on limited time, so I'll just make a quick comment, hang up, and your guest can hopefully comment.
Sure.
I've been listening to the discussion today, and it's very interesting and very thoughtful and provocative. It does seem to me that there's an 800-pound elephant in the room, and we're kind of slipping around it. Out-of-wedlock rate for black females is something like 70%, and I don't know how many programs, state or otherwise, you're never going to fill the void of having two parents. And it seems to me that child has got 2.5 strikes against it at the time of birth if you're not going to have two supportive parents. And I don't know... Well, I guess it comes down to accountability and responsibility, I think, is the main line here. And I can appreciate their differences and cultural problems. But I think in the final analysis, if you're going to have sex and have a baby, at some point you have to step up to the plate and take responsibility. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well?
Well, I guess I would argue that most of these men, in fact, are quite responsible fathers. They simply don't have the income to push their children out of poverty. But they do actually provide for their children. If their children need clothes, they'll do their best to get the clothes. Their children need diapers, they do their best to get the diapers. So they do actually provide for their children, but I guess not in the traditional sense that we think about provisions. So it may not be regular, but they actually do their best. And the question is, what type of supports, what can the state do to support families, regardless of the family structure? Because we're really talking about poor people. How does the state support poor families, whether there's a mother and father in the home or just a father or just a mother? And the answer for me is that the state has to, at a minimum, provide them with decent employment. Right? Because you can't expect fathers or mothers to provide what children need if they cannot access wages.
Well, is there, though, a perception that out-of-wedlock birth is a problem?
Certainly, there's that perception. And that's historical, right? Because we have this idea that the best family and environment for a child is within a nuclear family. So if a child is born out of wedlock, then that's a problem. And it is a problem to some extent if we think about especially adolescents who are childbearing, because not that adolescents haven't always given birth, they always have, but in this day and age, adolescents cannot afford to take care of children, and they're less likely to marry at that age.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point that we have to finish up. Any last sort of thought that you might like to leave with people?
No, I mean, I think you did a great job of covering everything. I do think, though, that I do want to emphasize that my argument doesn't emphasize culture. Rather, it's one based on structure, how society is structured to support or not support families.
All right. Well, at that, we will leave it. And if you would like to read the book that we have mentioned, that's the result of the work that our guest Jennifer Hamer has done. The book is titled What It Means to Be Daddy, Fatherhood for Black Men Living Away from Their Children. It's published by the Columbia University Press, and also her more recent. And this actually is in print now, right? The Abandoned People in Abandoned Cities?
It'll be out this year, later this year.
Okay. To be out later this year, based on some of the work that she's talked about that she has done in East St. Louis, Abandoned People in Abandoned Cities, Working Class African-American Men and Women Negotiating Work, Kin Care, and Family. And that's Rutgers University Press. All right. Our guest, Jennifer Hamer, she is Associate Professor in the African-American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.